Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas is named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an author and documentarian who studies human autonomy in a digital age. His 20 books include the just-published Team Human, based on his podcast, as well as the bestsellers Present Shock, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, Program or Be Programmed, Life Incorporated, and Media Virus. He also made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like, The Persuaders, and Merchants of Cool. He's a professor of media theory and digital economics at Queen's College, a columnist for Medium, and his novels and comics, Ecstasy Club, ADD, and Alistair and Adolf are all being developed for the screen. And Doug has been a friend of mine for at least 30 years. How are you doing, Doug?
<That's true. laughs> Welcome, Doug. It's always great to reconnect with you. And I'm very eager to hear what kinds of tools you had for us, even though tools may not be the first thing you like to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I like tools. I just don't want to, like, I get concerned about fetishizing tools that I'm, you know, somehow just serving to promote consumerism. But I know that you're not thinking of tools that way, but tools as extensions of humankind.
Well, no, actually, I think of tools as possibilities. And the whole point of talking about really cool tools is not that we want you to buy them, but we want you to know that they exist, because their existence can open up possibilities and things in your mind that you may not have thought of. So it's not about having to buy all these. It's knowing that they exist and what they could do.
Mm-hmm. So that you basically, you create more possibilities for human creativity.
Right, exactly. Both individually and collectively. So you on board?
I'm on board.
Okay, tell us about one of your cool tools.
Well, one of them, I mean, the first one I thought of was written language. And written language is definitely a tool. I mean, I know it's a medium, it's an environment, there's all these ways to think about it, but I love thinking about words as a tool, because particularly when I'm mad about something or I feel like there's something that people don't get, once I can put words around it, once I can articulate what's happening, what people are feeling, or the dysfunction or the paradox, once I can put words to it, I feel like it empowers me and so many other people to then go do something about it. You know, I look at that written language is what allowed us to record history for the first time, which is when we started to, you know, really think about the past. It's when history was born. And written language is what allowed us to write contracts into the future. So I see written language, text, as the thing that really invented time, it invented progress, it invented a future and a history. And to this day, it feels not like going back, but like retrieving a really core human ability when we write something down, that the digital age, a lot of us have been arguing, you know, a lot of theorists, that the digital age retrieves the oral culture, that we're going back into what Ung would call secondary orality. But when I look at the net, I think, no, it's retrieved scribal culture. Everybody writing their little tweets and their posts and getting back involved in written language.
Doug, do you use Twitter a lot?
I hadn't been using it a lot. It's funny. I've been using Twitter in some ways in a bad way, just to tweet a link to something that I did, you know, kind of as a promotional platform, or to tweet things, I guess, that other people did. But now I've actually started to get involved in it. I'm looking at Twitter, you know, it does that. It lets me promote hard links, but it's also like a giant IRC, you know, the original internet relay chat, where you have these kind of real-time conversations with people in a room. And I'm no longer just seeing it as a place where people insult other people, but a place to really kind of ping ideas back and forth and to have discussions in a truncated but a very visceral way.
And it's written language too, to your point.
I know people call it a shouting match, but if you really start thinking about your words, if people would even take 5 minutes to craft their tweet, you just see how much better it gets.
Yeah. Unfortunately, right, exactly. A lot of people don't do that. And it's just like instant reaction to something.
So what's another tool that you have been excited by?
Well, the first real tool I thought of that's like a real tool is the Crane CC Pocket AM/FM radio. Crane is this, they're a radio company, but they're like nerds of radio. They really, really care about radio. And if you're a radio nerd like I am, I mean, before the internet, I'm old, right? Before the internet, I mean, we all had other media that we lived through. And for me, it was nighttime radio. I didn't sleep well as a kid. And my dad gave me his, it was a little Sylvania pocket transistor radio. And I lived with that thing. I kept it under my pillow and I would listen to late night radio. And the later it got at night, because it's something to do with the ionosphere, the further and weirder the AM radio stations you could get. So I would sit there, you know, at 2 a.m, tuning in, you know, the precursors to Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM and listen to these crazy conversations. And Gene Shepard, who was this weird radio.
Gene Shepard, yay, Flick lives.
It was amazing stuff. And I really prided myself on my ability. You had little tuning dials at that point. And when you tuned in an AM radio station, there were like different parts of the signal that you could get, you know, and you could move to the sort of the edge of the signal and increase the treble of the sound and hear it really clearly, or move to the middle of the signal and get away from overlapping stations. And I don't know, I kind of prided myself in my late night radio tuning, but these folks at Crane have developed, you know, digital equivalents of AM/FM radios, and they still get radio signal, but, you know, instead of having a dial, you have a button and it tunes in the exact, you know, 88.6, you know, the exact number, and kind of locks in the station. And, you know, I used a lot of radios, a lot of cheap radios under my pillow in the years since since the 70s. And the Crane is really this amazing tool. They you just know when you hold this thing and play with it, it gets stations I've never gotten before. I listen to Canada and Iowa and Alaska, you know, on this. It's insane. And I just love, you know, when you, I'm sure you guys think about this a lot, but when you hold in your hand something that was put together thoughtfully and you can feel it's like a solid item and the buttons work, you know, it's just like, it's this sort of physical pleasure of having something that actually does, it does something for me that I can't do myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sparks joy. And so, I'm just wondering, Doug, like, what kinds of things are you hearing on this late night, these remote places? What, I mean, we were just talking about Twitter and the kind of way that it amplifies outrage and stuff. But are you picking up a different vibe? Are you hearing things that you don't hear on Twitter, say?
Yeah, because I can hear the voices of people. I mean, I tune in almost exclusively to either, you know, deep red state late night radio and hear, you know, people who are upset about, you know, what I would call neoliberalism and, you know, top-down capitalism and social control and all that. I mean, and a lot of them are Trump supporters and poor people. And I listen to a lot of, you know, good UFO late night madness.
Art yeah, Bell, yeah.
I mean, or now right. George Norrie, those folks. And what I hear, though, is something different than, I mean, I'm sure a lot of these are the same people who have those big American flags on their Twitter profiles and say things in a sentence that make you cringe. But when you hear their voice and don't, you know, put up your defense mechanisms and hear where they're actually coming from, I can hear the humanity. I can hear the frustration. I can hear the fear. And just so many more of the sort of social mechanisms I have for establishing rapport with other human beings are activated when I hear their voices. It's funny. I mean, I was talking about text before, but text is so cold compared to the human voice. So when I hear that, I mean, it's changed the way I'll listen and I'll think, oh, I get what Trump means here. I get why, you know, I understand the emotional logic of what's going on. And it's just changed my feeling about people that I might normally be afraid of.
Right. I mean, you just made a great case for a tool that can take you out of your bubble in a real way, and not just a way that will inflame you and get you outraged to say something snarky back. You actually have to listen, and you can't talk back. And so you, and then you say, and it's conveying this voice, which is this a much stronger emotive dimension than a little tweet.
Right. And it's terrestrial. And, you know, it's what we call now terrestrial radio. So you don't, it's not packets. You don't need the network. You don't, it's just, there's this place that's beaming out this signal, and my little device under my pillow somehow hears that thing, right? It's not going through my Wi-Fi. It's not going.
It's like whispering.
It's magic. I feel like
kids are really surprised that you can get like over the air television and even radio.
You don't have to pay for it either.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is great. So we're on a roll. What's another a tool that you are excited by?
You know, the microphone I'm using right now was kind of a find. It's a Rode NT USB microphone. You know, and I wasn't a fan of USB microphones at all. Again, because I'm just so old. I want my analog. I want my SM58, you know, or my SM7B, you know, what I want my old rock and roll mic, and you plug it into a mixer, and then if you've got to go digital, then you've got a digital audio, you know, an audio analog to digital converter, and plug it into your computer. And I saw all these things, and nothing against anybody, but I don't like the sound of all those blue USB mics, which are kind of the ones everyone has, the Yeti and
the Yetis.
Snowball and the this and the that. And but I had to get something because it just was too complicated. I've got my office, I've got my home. So I figured, okay, here in the basement, I'll have one decent USB plug-in microphone for emergencies. And so I got this Rode NT USB mic, and it wasn't a lot of money. And I plugged it in and had to do one of my monologues for my podcast on this thing instead of my regular. And I was like, wow, I kind of like the sound of my voice on this mic better than my big expensive one. And it's like, what is it? And I think for whatever reason, and you look in this thing, it's got a giant capsule in there. I mean, it's a big microphone capsule, like the size of something that you'd see in a you know, one of those super, you know, $10,000 microphones that you record, you know, voiceover on. And there was something about this mic that's just, there's something that's clean and unmuffled, just so, you know, nothing extraneous about it. And then mysteriously, and for whatever reason, this mic doesn't pick up the dryer and the washing machine that are in the next room in the basement here, because that's where I record. So the dryer can be on, the washing machine's on, and it's not picking up any background noise. It's just right here in the room. And that's, I'm sure it would be really useful for a lot of people who are.
That's cool.
Yeah, recording
and
stuff.
And I think
that's
rare for a condenser mic. Like dynamic mics, I think, are known to kind of have a rapidly dropping sphere of sensitivity. As you move farther out, it can't hear things. So that's like a cool feature for a $170 condenser mic.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just pleased with that. And I just like when I'm using something a little bit different than everybody's using. You know, you see the typical setup for a podcast, and then it's like, maybe just give some little extra sonic, you know, specialness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. The Rode. Yeah, I use their wireless mics for my video, for my camera doing video, and they're plug and play. So I've been very happy with them.
Yeah, they're really nice.
That's That's R-O-D-E.
Yeah. I mean, there's one tool I wouldn't use from them that I bought, which was this, it's this little thing, you plug it into your iPhone, and then it has two outputs, and they give you, or two inputs, and they give you two little clip-on mics to use, so you could do like a emergency podcast. And I would keep that around with me, but it really doesn't sound like real clip-on microphones. It sounds like, you know, those little Radio Shack ones that you'd get for $9 back in the day. You know, you can really hear the difference.
So Doug, your next one, this is interesting. I've never heard of it. It's a special kind of mobile phone.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy, Bas van Abel, who is an artist in Holland, and he found out about how, you know, they send little African children into caves to get the rare earth metals for our smartphones. Mm-hmm. And he thought, as a kind of an art project, he would see if he could make a slave-free, environmentally friendly cell phone, smartphone. And so he started a company called Fairphone. And they're based in Europe. And I mean, they've sold a few hundred thousand of these things now. And so they make an Android phone called a Fairphone, which is completely modular. So it's got all these different parts in it that you can, you know, your soundboard and your camera and your battery and everything is all replaceable and changeable and upgradable. And he tried to get to source everything in ways that didn't use slaves, but wouldn't make the price of the phone exorbitantly high. And he was able to do it for like 80 or 90% of the phone. He was able to source that way. But some of it, there are these parts he just had to get from those marketplaces in China. And, you know, some of the provenance of those parts is not what it should be. So instead of calling it, you know, Fairphone, when we're in conversation, he'll call it Fairer Phone. At least it's fairer to people than what's out there. But it's a great little thing. And you open up the back and you look at the battery and it says the change is in your hands. And the idea that we can, through our consumer choices, really push supply chains toward more equitable resource solutions. And it really does make sense. I mean, we're not going to go back and get rid of these phones, but we can move forward in much more environmentally and labor conscious ways.
And how would you compare? So it's like $450. How would you compare it to, or 450 pounds actually? So I don't know, is that like $600?
Right.
If you were to buy a $600 Android phone, do the features match up side by side pretty well?
Pretty well. I mean, in all honesty, there's some, I mean, it'll run the latest Android whatever. And the camera is pretty nice and replaceable. And it's all very open source. So you can kind of, you know, retool certain things yourself. But the phone itself right now only goes up to 3G. Mm. You know, and while there are 3G networks around, I mean, I think the new one might go to 4G, but they don't do 4 LTE. And they're not even looking at, you know, 5G yet. So, you know, you're slightly behind in terms of your network coverage. So, I mean, honestly, I when I go to Europe, I'll pop my card in and use it over there. But I'm sad to say I've stopped using it in the States because there's so many areas now that, you know, you really can't get 3G even anymore, but you've got to be 4G or above. But I'm hoping if people kind of support the technology or have demand for it, that it's the kind of thing that even if we don't get the Fairphone itself here, that some other phone companies might look at, well, why don't we try making one phone, you know, in a more socially conscious way?
I think it's incredible that someone was able to make something as complex as a mobile phone from scratch, you know, and kind of be mindful of the provenance of all the materials. Pretty cool.
Right. It's an amazing project. Yeah.
Does he publish the provenance? Does he publish a kind of a teardown where he says, this is where this component came from? That would be, to me, kind of useful.
Yeah, I believe pretty much everything is up there on their website. And it's Fairphone, you know, it's about F-A-I-R-P-H-O-N-E. I think pretty much everything is up there. And the phone itself is so easy. I mean, I just took off the back. The body of the phone is a case, so you don't get a case in addition to the phone. You don't really need one, but you peel the back off really easily. And it sort of labels everything that's in there. This is your camera. This is what you can open. This you better not touch. You know, so it's kind of like it's a very modular Lego-like, like Arduino. It looks like an Arduino assembled phone inside there.
That's really cool. That's good.
Yeah.
So let's see. What else do we have, Doug? Just quickly tell us about the waffle maker, and then I want to move on to your other projects.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was my daughter wanted me to start making waffles because I make these. I make waffles here, like turkey waffles, where I put turkey in the waffle.
Whoa!
It sounds awful, but it's actually good. It's a sweet and savory, protein filled treat.
Uh-huh. I would try it.
Of course, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, or you could certainly use turkey bacon or something if you want to make sure it feels mm-hmm. breakfasty. But I was in, I think, Target, and we saw these little things. It's a Dash mini waffle maker, and it's $9.99. So, I mean, what kitchen appliance that you actually plug in costs $9.99? I don't know. And maybe it could be slave involvement in something that's this cheap. But it's a great little thing. You just plug it in, you pour in your waffle mix, and you know, there's a little light that sort of indicates when it's at proper temperature. And I use the light to sort of figure out when my waffle is done as well. And it's all, you know, stick free and it's just this perfect, you know, when you find one of these things, it's a perfect little thing for what you do. And we're better at small waffles than big. I'm a firm believer in silver dollar pancakes and tiny waffles, that the smaller the thing is, I don't know if this is geometrically true, but it seems as if there's more surface area than per ounce of food. And I like the surface. I like the skin of the waffle or the sides of the pancake more than the insides. So we make mini things. Yeah. We make mini omelets and mini waffles and mini pancakes. And we can control our dosing better that way, too.
Yeah.
You should probably love Japan, too, who likes little bite-sized things.
Very cute little waffle maker. What color did you get? The red one?
We did get the red one. I might have opted for that sort of aqua turquoise one, but I think that's almost become a too typical color now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Cool. Doug, you've got a couple of things. Yeah, tell us about, you have a book and podcast that you've been doing a podcast for a while, and you have a new book based on it, but it's called Team Human. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, Team Human is, in some ways, I look at it as my last project. It's funny. It was
your last project? Wait. What do you mean by your last?
Well, certainly my most recent one. But it was funny when I started writing it as a book, it started to feel like my last book. Like it was on the one hand, it was encapsulating everything I had written in the other 19 books, but in a tiny little manifesto. So I was able to condense like the entirety of Programmer Be Programmed, which is already a pretty short book, into like 800 words, and Media Virus is 1600 words in there. And my Life Inc. book is, you know, two teeny little, you know, 1,000 word chapters. And I was like, wow, you know, this actually, what makes me feel like a better writer is that I can say more with fewer words, that I can get big points across that then, you know, unfold in people's minds afterwards, but I don't have to say that much to get that thought process initiated. And, you know, Team Human is here really to assert a role for human beings in the digital future. I got the idea for it when I was on a panel with Ray Kurzweil, of all people. And he was, you know, making his argument about how information wants to evolve towards higher states of complexity, and human beings have sort of maxed out on our complexity. So information is going to have to migrate into the digital realm, and human beings should just sort of fade into the background and accept our, you know, inevitable extinction. And I argued, no, you know, human beings are weird and fun and crazy. We can embrace paradox, and we deserve a special place in the digital future. And he said, oh, Rushka, you're just saying that because you're a human. Right? As if it was hubris. And that's when I decided, no, I'm on Team Human. And I came up, you know, with that meme and decided I'm, you know, guilty. Yeah. Fine. I'm on team human. But the more I talked about it, the more I came to the understanding that human beings are not individuals, that we are a team, and that any technology or tool that brings us together is our friend and makes us more human. And anything that divides us, like, you know, many of the social media apps that we're using today and filter bubble platforms, those are not our friends. And it's also really, in some ways, it's my interpretation of Kevin's book, of what technology wants. Because as I read, I mean, I think it's what you intended. As I read it, it's a bait and switch. It looks like you're writing a book about what technology wants, like what this stuff wants. But what you really mean is more Shakespearean. It's what technology wants, like W-O-N-T wants, what it needs, what it wants is us. What it wants is intention. It doesn't have that. And without human beings filling the technology with our agenda and our attention, it's going to go off in some random way, however the tech is biased. But the tech doesn't want anything. We have to provide the why for the tech. And that's sort of what Team Human is saying, is here's a why. Here's some good cultural immune response for humanity to up our game and embrace the potentials that we've unleashed.
So just to clarify for people, so Team Human is a book that you have written. It is for sale on Amazon or other places. And it's done, right? I mean,
yes, it's a manifesto.
Right, it's a manifesto.
You can read it as a book for like whatever it costs. You know, a book costs like $10 these days if you go to the cheapest place. You can read it online for free. I'm posting it 1 week at a time. It's got 100 little sections, little almost little stanzas. And I'm posting them 1 week at a time on Medium. You can go to medium.com/team-human and read it. Or if you get impatient after the first year, you could just go buy the book. There's an audio book, and there's also a podcast where I talk to people who I'm looking at people along my journey, but people who are interpreting sort of the role of human beings in the world, you know, in the cosmos. I just did James Lovelock last week. He's 100 years old. He's the guy that came up with the Gaia hypothesis and has some really interesting ideas on sort of the co-evolution of humans and their tools.
That's crazy. Right. He has a new book out too.
He has a new book, the Novocene, which is a very short book, but it's actually very wonderful because he talks about this kind of, you know, transitional period that we're in, and it's visionaries in the truest
way. It is, and it's not that humans get replaced by machines, but, you know, we're really going to need each other to get through this next little dicey patch.
Yeah. So I'm a little concerned about this being your last project. What does that mean?
I felt like it might be my last book. I mean, I've written...
Your last book. That I completely understand, because I've been saying the same thing.
I'm tired of the books. I wrote 20 of them.
You're right. But books, they don't have the cultural significance that they used to have. And so...
You're so right. They really don't, you know. Yeah. And I wrote books that were less significant than Team Human that sold maybe 40,000 or 50,000 copies, you know. And now Team Human, which is, I see it. I mean, I see the influence of the book and the ideas, and that sells maybe, you know, 10,000 or 20,000. And they're just, it's not the way. The articles about the book spread the ideas more than the book itself. So I'm actually looking at theater, at doing some live theater in real places with real people. I want to do a community theater project where I'll distribute these scripts online to all these community theater groups around the country, let them each do their interpretations of these scenes that are really left very wide open to interpretation, and then videotape their scenes, put them on a central server, and then use some sort of collaborative filtering to see which scenes are people most intrigued by, and then fly them to the public theater in New York for performance in repertory. So it's a kind of for me, it's a return to the, you know, the medium I loved best.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of like you're kind of like workshopping it in a certain sense.
Exactly.
But with video as an intermediary.
But Doug, as another example of, like, you know, saying your last book project, you wrote that book Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, but now you're working on turning that into a documentary series.
Exactly. Tell us about that. Yeah. Well, the folks at Submarine, who are really a great little film TV company who did like Scanner Darkly, and they did the TV series Undone on Amazon, and the Bellingcat documentary that just got an Emmy. So they came to me and wanted me to work on some kind of project with them about technology. And so we're adapting Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, which is my book about kind of techno-capitalism and what we could actually do to foster a more distributed digital economy. And we're going to call it Exponential, you know, really looking at how the real world, nothing in the real world grows exponentially except cancer. Yet we're asking the real world to provide exponential returns through all of these digital companies. So we're going to do a 4-hour, you know, 4-evening documentary. And we've got, you know, 4 or 5 European stations on board. And I think they're talking to Netflix now about being the U.S. partner on it. And we're starting that in the spring.
That sounds so cool, Doug. Are you going to do some, are you going to host it also?
Yeah, I'll host it and go around. And I mean, hopefully they'll do some shoots in faraway places without dragging my body over there. But yeah, I mean, looking at everything from the sort of the original dream of the internet to how it, I would argue, was kind of co-opted by Wall Street to provide returns to the NASDAQ stock exchange. And then what that led to from surveillance capitalism to, you know, to Uber drivers and some of those problems to then, well, what can we do? What is a future that's more of a commons peer-to-peer driven digital economy, and how can we realize that, and who's already working on it?
That's cool. That's really great. And I feel that, you know, the center of the culture has drifted to moving images to in-person appearances. So you're absolutely right in your hunches that that's where the attention is going.
Yeah, it is towards live. And if it's not going to be live, it should be really fun. You know, I'm also still interested in graphic novels. I know you've done graphic novels as well. And this one, ADD, which is about gamers, it was a very futuristic tale 15 years ago when I wrote it, about a future where gamers would be on television and professionally competing in big tournaments and stadiums, which now has come to pass. So AMC, the TV network, they bought it to be a TV series. So I'm going to work with them on trying to envision that. And that, this would just be such fun, if any of them happen, such fun projects to kind of do at this stage of my career.
Isn't it remarkable how hard it is to stay ahead? You think you're writing something that's kind of like almost near impossible, and then 10 years later, it happens?
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, it's great because it means we're futurists with accuracy. But on the other hand, it's like, how do you do science fiction in a world that's changing faster than your imagination?
Exactly. Right. Yeah, I kept finding that happen with my books, and I was trying to kind of like, well, I need to go out 100 years, but that's like almost impossible to imagine. And yet, you know, anything less, they'll catch up before the book's dry. It's really hard.
I know. It's only like those sort of real Neal Stephenson kind of thinkers who can go so far, you know, into sort of genetic computer, whatever, that it's that it is beyond the imagination.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for me, the added challenge, which I like that where you're going, is to try to make an optimistic view of the future, how all this stuff works in a world that we want to live in. That's where it becomes really difficult to imagine.
But, I know.
But it's necessary and essential to imagine it. So I really applaud your efforts to kind of say, well, you know, here's where we're going, but let's imagine a world in which we have we have some of this technology and it works, and I want to live there.
Right. Right. What does it look like without the zombies? You know?
Right. Zombie free. Yes. Okay.
Zombie free.
I'm all for the zombie free future. I don't know about you, but I want the zombie free future. Well, this is great, Doug.
So cool. Really fun learning about your tools and talking to you about your projects and just your thoughts and everything. It's always fun.
Oh, thanks. I feel better about my tools now.
Oh, good. No, that was really, really great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Hey, everybody, it's Mark from the Cool Tools Podcast. I want to thank you for being a listener to Cool Tools. And I also would like to let you know about our Patreon page. If you would like to support the Cool Tools show, as well as our video channel, the website, and all the newsletters that we do, you can go to patreon.com/cooltools. That's just one word, Cool Tools, and pledge any amount you want. You could even pledge $1 a month. Every little bit helps. We have editors, we pay for transcribing costs, we pay our reviewers. Every bit of money that you contribute goes towards supporting the show. I'd like to give a shout out to our supporters of the Cool Tools Podcast. This week, I'd like to thank the following Patreon supporters: Bill Schuler, Bob Kay, Brian Pelly, Carl D. Patterson, Chad Cosby, Chris Wieland, Chris Weirstook, Craig Tooker, Dan O'Brien, Dean Putney, Danelle Cunningham, Evan Barker, Graham Medlin, Hans Riesbeck, Helen Hegedus, Jerry Kearns, Jim Lesko, Jim Spofford, John Pollock, John Burdenbaugh, Keith O., Ken Altman, Les Howard, Lauren Bast, Mock Nerd, Malton Make, Mark Goebel, Matt Gromes, Michael Douglas, Michael Jones, and Michael Pecorini. Thanks to all of you for supporting the Cool Tools Show. We really appreciate it.